welcome to the Pilates Progressions Program. This is Katrina Foe, your host for tonight. I'm so excited to talk with you tonight. We've got some great questions lined up, and one of them is probably my favorite topic, so you can guess that it might have to do with pregnancy. You guys have probably heard me talk about this a lot, and we have some interesting little things, tidbits and questions that I want to just tickle your ears with tonight. We've also got some fun things coming up at the studio. So this weekend we have Matt 2. So if you haven't had Matt 2, this is a good time. If you want to sign up, you still have some time. Go ahead and you can hop on Pilates.com to register through Balanced Body and get that all taken care of. So I hope if you have already taken Matt 2 that you are using that information, because a lot of those exercises, you know, get kind of lost along the wayside. And there are some fabulous stuff there. Not for everybody. Not everyone is ready for them, but good stuff nonetheless. All right. So first off, we're going to start with this question on pregnancy. And I just want to say that I'm going to give some other information about pregnancy afterwards. Okay, she wrote, "Hi, Katrina. Hope all is well with you and your beautiful children. I have a couple of questions for you, as I'm teaching a client who is going to have her first baby around June 19th. I did my homework to prepare to teach someone who is expecting a baby, and I'm using, of course, the pregnancy lesson plans. However, I would like for you to tell me whether elephant, arabesque, and jackrabbit on the reformer are at this point of the pregnancy still an option. Also, I understand the reason for controlling and limiting stretching, but what about spinal movements such as side bending and rotation? Parentheses, my client is very athletic and, quote, bendy. She also has a good amount of rotation, but I'm not sure to which extent this should be limited at this point. As I'm getting up very early in the morning, I haven't been able to listen to the radio show." Oh, sorry, that was it. Okay, so that's the question. And I just want to, first off, commend you for going over the material and being prepared, because working with pregnant clients is quite the honor, and it's very, you know, something you should take weighty. So a lot of times instructors get overwhelmed by the fact that, oh my goodness, this person's pregnant, I could kill their baby, I could really hurt them, and they get very, very fearful around this. So my favorite thing to do is to impart a lot of this information with a lot of empowerment. I want you guys to come away from this feeling excited about all that you can do, because there's so many benefits, and we have so much that we can do with a client that is pregnant, that I want to really emphasize that. So hopefully that's coming across really loud and clear. First off, that to me is the most important thing. So if that's not coming across, I want to just mention that, so that you guys can really focus on hearing that message, if you will. Okay, so pregnancy. You've got your basic contraindications that we go over in the video, so I'm just going to bullet point those. If you haven't watched the P3 pregnancy lecture, go back over that to get the full ifs, ands, who, why, where, when, all that about this. I'm just going to cover the bullet points just as a quick review, but I go into a lot of explanation as to why behind these, because I think if you understand the why, it makes more sense. But just for a quick review, so you have no extreme range of motion, and again, that's relative to the individual, no intense adductor work of the legs, so at the hip joint, so inner thighs, light adductor work can be good, but not intense, no inversions, that's defined as your pelvis above your heart rate, or above your heart, not heart rate, excuse me, no supine exercises after the first trimester without some kind of an incline to be on. So that could be a spine supporter, or it could be a baby arc. It could be the pregnancy wedge is my favorite. You could have a whole bunch of pillows, a lot of different ways to do that. No prone exercises after the first trimester. And again, this is depending on the person. They may not want to do it right from the beginning. And then no heavy abdominal work. So that, by heavy abdominal work, I mean rectus abdominis. I am not talking about transverse abdominis. I'm talking about rectus, and that's because of the diastasis stuff. And again, I go into all of that, why behind that, in the pregnancy lecture. So that is kind of the quick and dirty, what you should not do. Now, I did the math, for especially for those of you that are listening to this in the future. This particular client, we're in March now. This would put her at about 26 weeks-ish, and which means she's just starting her third trimester. Okay, so sometimes it's good to keep that in mind, look at it on how many weeks they are and what trimester, and because it's going to really give you a guideline as to how far it is. And I say that because every person carries differently. Some people look like they're 9 months pregnant when they're 4 months pregnant. And some people, when they're 9 months pregnant, look like they're 4 months pregnant. So you really want to keep that in check and be aware of that. Oh, my goodness, she is getting close. So the third trimester, that's the last section of the pregnancy. And sometimes, you know, at this 26 weeks, they still might not be that big, especially if it's the first baby. But they're pretty far along. Now, in terms of pregnancy contraindications and such, I'm just going to kind of go off on a little bunny trail here. A lot of times you'll see a lot more specific contraindications, like, oh, at 22 and a half weeks, da-da-da-da. And all of these things that I've mentioned have different, you know, I tried to make it real simple, okay, because when you are working with a client, what happens, in my experience, is that you work with them and you do similar things each week and, you know, you mix it up, but you're doing similar things and you kind of forget that they're progressing week by week. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, whoops, it's 23 weeks and I wasn't supposed to do this because you're supposed to stop doing that at 22 weeks. Oh, no. You know, and I don't want you to get that fanatical about it. So I made the guidelines real clear. It's just after the first trimester that things change. All of those contraindications that I listed are for the entire time, okay? So with the exception of the prone and supine, and again, you still can do supine, you just have to do it with modification, but really the only thing is prone that you can do for a little while, you know, at the beginning, and supine you can do a little while at the beginning, but the rest of them you shouldn't be doing at all the entire time. So I made it kind of real clear with that. Okay. So what does that mean? That means that a lot of these exercises you don't want to do. And you might try to get into your head. Think about it from their perspective. If you start doing this great exercise and they fall in love with it, and then you're like, oh, can't do it. Sorry, you passed the 22-week mark, or, you know, whatever the arbitrary thing is. It kind of feels a little negative. Like, oh, okay, now all of a sudden I'm broken. You know, so we want to really smooth that over with a lot of love, and don't give them something if you're going to take it away. On the same note, you have to remember that even though they're not as large and the baby's not as big and everything, you still have a lot of the same hormones, all the same hormones that are going through your body, meaning especially the relaxin hormone that's causing a lot of the reasons why we do this. So I'm going to go through this and talk about these specific exercises, but I want you to keep those couple things in mind as it plays out. All right, so when considering an exercise, I've given you guys a list of the exercises you should and shouldn't do just to make it really easy for you so you don't have to think about it a whole lot, but I do want you to understand the why, and that's why I love that you asked this question. And we get a lot of questions like this, and I'm totally fine answering this all day long. Okay, so when you're trying to figure it out, there's two main things you want to consider. The first one is it contraindicated? Is this safe for the person? Is this appropriate for them? Physiologically. And then the second one, this is where most instructors stop, is does it feel good? Is it actually going to help them? Is there a purpose to doing this at this point in their life? Okay, and that's where a lot of instructors kind of miss the boat, especially for instructors that either haven't been pregnant before or instructors that have been pregnant but they weren't doing Pilates in their pregnancy, they've never done Pilates while they're pregnant. Or for a man who's never been pregnant and all that kind of stuff and has no idea about it. Not that men or people that haven't been pregnant or such can't train pregnant clients. Absolutely not. And quite frankly, even though I've been pregnant 5 times now, each one's different and each woman's body is different. And my body, having done Pilates before I'm pregnant, is going to be different than somebody's body that hasn't done Pilates before they're pregnant. And so there's a lot of variables here and you want to kind of keep that in mind. So, first one. Okay, we're going to go through contraindications. We just mentioned some of those. And that's usually the most important thing, safety-wise. So, elephant. We're going to start with that one. Elephant is an inversion. if you do the classical full elephant. Elephant meaning your pelvis is above your heart. And I go into in the pregnancy lecture why that is not a good idea. And I'll just mention some of those things because the arabesque that we're going to talk about next is in that same category. So both of those, the pelvis should be above the heart unless they're just really inflexible. So we're not going to go there because most people are flexible enough to get it above the heart. So why do we not do that? Okay, first off, there's a lot of discussion about air embolisms. Air embolisms are where air would go into the uterus through the vagina from the outside, and it could, because of the way the placenta is attached to the side wall of the uterus, could actually enter the woman's bloodstream. And if it's in air bubbles in the woman's bloodstream, it could cause a stroke. Not a good thing. Not going to kill the baby, but I don't think too many clients want the possibility of a stroke. Now, this is extremely rare, and I have found very little documented evidence on it, but there's kind of that idea of, like, do you really want to go there? Do you really want to take a chance that, somebody could have that happen? And then we're going to get to the second criteria in a second, but there's also the discussion of babies when they are in their position, whether head down, head up, head sideways, as one of mine was, can actually have an effect of the direction of gravity in terms of them turning around. So one of the techniques, which I have used on my second baby, Lainey, she was actually breech, so head up when she should be head down, not a good thing. A lot of people won't even let you push vaginally. They just automatic C-section nowadays, so it is a fairly serious thing. And we actually inverted her, got her to flip over by doing an inversion because inversions are very powerful in terms of the position of the baby. So you want to take this seriously. Now, in terms of if the baby is head down, there's not a lot of evidence that doing inversion would turn the baby the other way. However, there's not evidence that there isn't, meaning people aren't doing studies on that direction, if that makes sense. They're doing it on how to flip the baby the other way. And again, there's still not a lot of actual scientific research-based evidence. It's more anecdotal and things that people have done. But I will say from my own experience, it took one time. One time. We did an inversion, and the inversion technique was similar to doing like a bridge position. So it wasn't even as, you know, extreme as it is similar to like doing an elephant. And we flipped the baby. I mean, literally, it grossed Larry out because you could see the baby kind of moving in terms of flipping the head down. So if you go on the website, spinningbabies.com, super cool website, they do a lot of discussion about how to do these inversion techniques. And one of the things they do is an inversion technique very similar to an elephant. It's actually even more similar to the cat kneeling from the top of the chair. Okay, so your hands, usually they do it on stairs, but it's got that same where your hands are lower than your knees kind of position. So you're inverted. And they use it to release some of the round ligaments, which can get really, I don't know, wound up, for lack of a technical term, and be very painful and not comfortable for the woman and can cause some fetal discomfort in terms of poor positioning. But they discuss this position, and the big critical thing is that you've got to keep your head down. Your chin has to be touching your chest or at least going that direction as much as possible while you're doing this the whole time, because if you don't, you can actually overstretch the broad ligament, which is the ligament in the front of the pubic cavity that comes up and attaches to the uterus. And again, overstretching ligaments, very, very serious. You could have some possible problems with uterus positioning and such, which could cause problems with the baby delivery and such. So big thing. And I'll just tell you, what is the first thing that a client does with their head when they're doing the elephant? I know how many of you can keep their clients' heads down guaranteed every time. I can't. My clients always have their head up, and they don't even know they have the head up. I mean, that's one of the most common corrections I do, and I don't even say anything. I just put my head, bop it on the back of their head, drop it down. It's like every single time it's at like a 90-degree angle with their arms, okay? I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about. So for those reasons, I don't think in terms of safety and, appropriateness and contraindications, that elephant and arabesque would be a great choice. Okay? Now, I'm going to talk about those two more, and then I will get to jackrabbit. In terms of elephant and arabesque, the other thing is, gets into, does it feel good? Is there a point to it? Is this a good thing for a pregnant body? Because there are so many exercises that a pregnant woman can do that, like, don't go against contraindications. But there's a lot of them that when you're pregnant, you're like, oh, that does not feel good. It's just awkward, and it puts a lot of stress on places that don't need stress. I mean, one of my things that drives me absolutely insane is I'll watch pregnancy videos, and I'm looking at them going, oh, good night. You could not possibly think that that's good for a pregnant lady, because they do tons of stuff, like kind of reclining with their, you know, they're kind of wedged up on like a, they usually do a makeshift pregnancy wedge, and they do things with their legs in the air, kind of like toe taps and stuff. It's like all psoas, hip flexory stuff, awful. Like, I can just feel my hip flexors tighten up because they're trying to not do ab work lying down. And so they're giving an appropriate modification. But if you've been pregnant and try to do that stuff when you're pregnant, it is like the worst feeling ever. So again, it doesn't go against contraindications, but it's not doing them any good, and it doesn't feel good. Probably your clients will say, okay, and they'll be dutiful little people and do their stuff because they see you as the professional and you must know what's good for their body. But I want you guys to be more than just the professional that can tell, spout off the contraindications. I want you to know it's actually going to be therapeutic and feel good and do their body good. So a lot of that kind of stuff, you've got to really take with a big grain of salt of, does it feel good? Is it going to be something that's actually going to impart some goodness and bring some good benefits, sorry, lost some words there, to their body? And in that respect, elephant does usually feel pretty good for a pregnant client. But again, we don't want to mess with their ligaments. So if you can do their elephant, absolutely make sure that they keep their head down. Maybe you could go there. But it depends on you and your client, and you've done the elephant before. And you, but again, you don't want to overstretch that ligament. Arabesque, same thing. You know, I just don't necessarily recommend it for all those reasons and such. The reason that most people tend to go to elephant and arabesque is because of the low back stretch and the calf stretch and stuff that is imparted with elephant and the hamstring stretch, because pregnant women tend to get so tight and achy there. So if you're looking for that, I would say look somewhere else. Or maybe do it with a different position or something. You can get a little creative and have them do maybe a flat back elephant. You'll still get the stretch for most people, especially a pregnant lady, and have them bring their chest more upward like you would do for an osteoporotic person or something like that. Things like that. Arabesque, again, if you're doing the real full arabesque with the one leg up in the air and the heel propped up on the shoulder rest, you know, not like flamingo where the leg's bent, or, you know, one-legged elephant where you have the hips square or something like that, but the true full arabesque, it's a little precarious. And I would say there's also a risk of the pregnant lady, you know, losing their balance, especially when you're talking about in the third trimester. Their balance just gets off because this baby's getting bigger and their center of gravity is changing. So, again, you want to be careful, especially at our studio because we have the higher reformers, the like clinical height they call it sometimes. Okay, so it is an option. You're not going to kill anyone, but is it a good option? I don't know. Jackrabbit, on the other hand, let's go over that. So jackrabbit, a good, appropriate jackrabbit, that's going to be great core work, great leg work, great shoulder work, and there's no contraindications it's going against. I see absolutely nothing with jackrabbit. The only thing with jackrabbit is that, is it something that the client can do? Now, a lot of pregnant clients are fit before they get pregnant, and it's totally an appropriate thing to be doing. Okay, I see nothing wrong with jackrabbit. You know, I think it's a great exercise. I think that for me personally, some of my pregnancies I've been very, very sick to where I've lost a lot of weight. I think I lost like 20 or 30 pounds within a month time with Hadley, and a lot of that was muscle that I lost. And the place I thought was interesting that I lost the most muscle by far was my quads. I just had no quad strength. So again, that would be a good exercise in my case, to have worked on that and keep that up, because it was the area that you lose it. And I've heard people say that the statistics show that when people get older, as they lose muscle mass, they lose it the most in their quads. That's why older people, you know, there's a joke, I've fallen and I can't get up, you know, that kind of stuff. And they can't get up and stand up out of couch, off couches and off the toilet and stuff. That's a quad strength thing. So you think about, how does a pregnant lady get up? Yeah, you know, what do? They put their hands behind them and push themselves up. Quad strength, hello. So many of them to do it because their quads aren't strong enough and such. So that's a really important, good thing functionally that can really help them. I mean, how often do you see a pregnant lady, oh, here, give me a hand up, or they kind of turn to the side to get up? So very functional. I see nothing wrong with Jackrabbit. I think it's a great choice. I don't think it feels bad when you're pregnant. However, you may need to adjust the springs a little bit, okay, because their core is not going to be as strong because it's stretched out just a little bit. So you're going to have to take that into consideration. And so for me, when I'm not pregnant and I'm back in shape, I do, you know, like the typical springs of like down stretch, you know, up stretch, long stretch, all that jackrabbit, all those on 1.5, like a red and a blue kind of a thing. And when I'm pregnant, I do it on like 2 reds. Or when I'm like at the end, it's like 2 reds and a blue. Okay, so you can tell there's a big difference, and that difference is in my core. My core needs a little bit of help, which means that as I up the spring to help my core, my legs and arms are going to have to be more in touch to be able to not fly off of there. So that's not necessarily the settings for everybody. I just want to give you, I'm kind of an average person, to give you some idea of what you might expect, especially if you get a really petite client. There's no way you're going to be able to put that much spring on there and not have them fly off. And again, that could hurt them and be worse than before. But just be aware that it's really great. This is one of the reasons it's really wonderful to get to work with a client before they're pregnant, so they know the exercise, and you can just say, you know, do you need more help? Do you need more support from the springs? And you can just give them some more or less, depending on the exercise, to make it feel the same, to give them that help with it as their core is being stretched out. Okay. Now, on to the second part of the question. Hopefully that answered it very thoroughly. But if you have more questions, or if you'd like me to go through this on a different particular exercise, anybody, whether it's the person that wrote this originally or somebody else, I'd be happy to, because I can give you the lowdown, what feels good and what doesn't. And that's where some of those pregnancy lesson plans come in, of what feels good. And then I try to give it some flow and choosing equipment and such like that. Okay, so the second part was about limiting the range of motion. So not focusing on creating more flexibility. And she said she understands the reason, but I'm just going to go over it again because not all of you may remember it. But I talk in the pregnancy lecture a lot about the relaxin. The hormone relaxin is being released from the moment that the egg implants into the uterus. And that moment is actually before you find out you're pregnant. So you don't find out you're pregnant till, you know, a couple of weeks afterwards. So when you find out, that relaxin is already going through your body. Okay, so none of this like, oh, well, I just found out, so it doesn't count. Yeah, it does. Also, that relaxin is going to continue going through your body as long as you're lactating. So that's one of the big reasons, the most important reasons, that you need to know if your client is lactating. Okay, and you can do this in such a positive way, in asking if they're breastfeeding, congratulating them and encouraging them in that journey if they are, because it is so, so important for that baby's health that they are breastfeeding as long as they can, as much as they can. And unfortunately, our society does not encourage and make it easy and support that choice. Okay, enough on that. But when that relaxin is going through the system, one of its jobs is to loosen and open up those ligaments. Now, it is doing that so that the ligaments that hold the pelvis together can open up, and you know, it's got a gradual long time to work to open that up. But as that pelvis is opening up, all the other joints in the body get some too. Okay, so you want to be careful that, you know, the knees might be a little more unstable, or you know, their shoulders or whatever it is, that you're not overstretching them. And rumor has it that a lot of pregnant women get very excited because they have this newfound flexibility. Now, personally, I was always so nauseous that I wasn't really looking for doing crazy things, especially at the beginning. But that's just me. And I knew this from before I was pregnant, so the first time even. So it wasn't something I was looking at. But everybody's body reacts a little differently. And if you get a client that's just like, look at me, I can do the splits, you just stop them. This is not something that's going to hurt the baby, not going to kill the baby. It's just going to possibly leave the pregnant client with permanently loose ligaments after they're done. Okay, so we don't ever want to overstretch these ligaments because those are our, there are stability for those joints. And if they get over loosened in pregnancy by doing too much stretching, then they'll stay that way. Okay, they should tighten back up after you're done with the relaxin, after you're done lactating and having the baby and everything. They don't ever get necessarily back to exactly what they were, but they should get tighter. They won't if you keep stretching this, though. And so the implications are not that it's going to hurt the mom right then. They're not going to break their arm or dislocate their shoulder necessarily right then. But 10, 20, 30 years down the road, when they have a history of chronically unstable joints and they end up with either, you know, some kind of itis there or the dislocation or instability that causes some injuries, that's what's going to happen later down. And so they're probably never going to point back, oh, I shouldn't have done that in Pilates. It's ever since then, my body's never been the same. They're not going to associate with you. But because you are an altruistic person and have their best interests at heart, you're not going to want to be doing that because it's not what's best for their body long term. Okay, so not killing any babies. Not going to snap, crackle, pop, hurt the mama, but you're going to set them up for injuries way into the future. Okay, so even though the person's bendy, we're not focusing on bendy. Now, if this person is very bendy, it's not to say they can't do range of motion they had before. You're just not trying to get any extra. Okay, so very, very common. If you have someone that is hypermobile, so a lot of dancers, gymnasts, and people that aren't dancers or gymnasts tend to be very bendy, as this person is described, and that person may have unstable joints to start with. So it's going to be even more important that you don't push it for them because they are already at risk for having more injuries than someone that has very stable joints and very tight ligaments. That's the pro-con thing. See, you've got people that are really tight and they whine about, oh, I need to get more flexibility. And then you got the people that are really flexible and hypermobile that are like, look at me, look what I can do. The negative with the hypermobile people is that they are way more susceptible to injury, way more. Okay, the stable people, not so much. Okay, they're more prone to tightness. Okay, so we want to kind of even that out and see the positives and benefits to both. So with a hypermobile person, whether they're pregnant or not, you're not trying to increase their flexibility. Okay, unless they have a very specific need, like they're a high level athlete that needs that for that sport, you want to do that with very, very big amount of caution, and you're focusing on the stability and the strength in that flexibility, not just getting more flexibility. So my analogy there is, okay, how many, think of a ballerina dancer, okay, how many of them can go, like, past the splits, or even just plain splits, okay? A lot of regular clients can do the plain splits, but how many people can utilize that flexibility and when they're standing upright on one leg, bring their other leg so that it touches their cheek? Not very many. So it's not that they need more flexibility for those a lot of those sports, it's that they need strength in that end range. A big difference, and that's where Pilates can really help. Okay, so going back to the question, I know, extra information on little bunny trails for you guys. So spinal movements, very, very good question. So in terms of controlling and limiting stretching in the spinal movements, yes, it's the same exact things. There are ligaments that attach the vertebrae together, and then there's little muscles that cause a movement between each vertebrae, and you have the same thing. So you're not trying to get more motion, but you're not trying to, you know, minimize it or anything. You don't want to go either way. Here's the bottom line. When you're talking about side bending and rotation, as she gets bigger, she's not going to be able to side bend or rotate because that baby is going to just kind of be like a little brace in there. And that's one of the things that I get saddest about, because about 30 weeks on, and again, it totally depends on the person, the baby is so big that I'm starting to lose side bending, rotation, flexion, extension. You just can't go anywhere. And I always joke that, you know, once I have the baby, it's like, ooh, look at me, my spine moves again. It's so much fun. And, you know, I feel like just jumping on that reformer and doing, you know, something like semicircle, because you just feel so undulatey. But so I don't usually address this particular question in my pregnancy protocols because it ends up being a moot point that the person can't do it. If they can side bend and rotate, awesome, enjoy it. I think that particularly side bending and rotation is very helpful in the thoracic area. So up where the rib cage is, I think it's very, very critical and important to focus on getting that motion in there, because what happens is in that area, those ribs moving up and down in conjunction with the side bending and rotation gets very limited, and you, as the baby gets bigger, the breathing gets limited. So by increasing the movement in the side bending and rotation, or just maximizing what you have, you will make sure that you still get enough breath in. Okay, so you're stretching the muscles that are in between the ribs, the intercostal muscles, and with the side bending and rotation movements, and that can allow them to get more breath in and do better ribcage breathing that we work on a lot with them. So in that aspect, I would focus on thoracic rotation and side bending, okay? Focus a lot on extension. You didn't mention that, but I'm going to throw that in there because they tend, you know, the breasts get bigger and they tend to get that kyphotic. If they weren't already before, they get more kyphotic. And as soon as that baby comes, that's just going to compound it because they're going to be holding that baby, hopefully nursing, and they're just going to slump over. Look at that baby, and they're, you know, cooing and, you know, coddling that baby as they should, but it contributes to worse and worse posture. So you want to try to encourage the extension so they can be upright as much as possible. And I'll be the first one to admit that is my biggest stumbling block with every pregnancy, is I get very, very kyphotic and I have to work like crazy to go against it. So one of the best things you could do is work on upper back extension in the thoracic area when they're pregnant, so that they have that strength going out of it, and it's there for them. So where can you do that? Not a lot of places, because you killed all the prone extension work, right? So there's very few places. One of my favorite is the downstretch on the reformer. And again, I mentioned earlier, you want to do probably more springs so it doesn't go into their low back. Their core can still support it. I also really, really like the spread eagle on the tower or Cadillac. And then there's also the standing springs swan standing. And that one's a little more unconventional. It's not a classical Pilates exercise, but again, it's my way of trying to get in another place that I can do extension when I'm pregnant. So there's some creative places you can do it, but those are the classical Pilates stuff that you can do. And I think that's really important. So hopefully that answers that question. Oh, in terms of the spinal motion and side bending and rotation, my favorite places that feel so good to work on that when they're pregnant, again, we're focusing on the thoracic, is side bend twist. So Cleopatra, side body twist, this is side bend twist, didn't I? Side body twist on the reformer, side body twist on the chair, side body twist on the Cadillac. You see the picture. But that particular exercise really, really gets into the thoracic area, unlike any other aspect of rotation. So I think I'd probably have to say it's my favorite on the reformer, but any of those places is great, just fabulous. So hopefully that helps you. They're just not going to be able to side bend and rotate as much as they progress in the lumbar area. And, of course, the cervical area is always great because people tend to get kyphotic, their neck's tight, and it's a good thing to do. You're just not looking for, like, adding an increasing range of motion as much as, you know, you don't want to stretch those ligaments. All right, well, hopefully that answers that question thoroughly and will give you some insight. Okay, I am going to go to the next question. Here we go. Hello, Katrina. This is my first time sending an email to you. Yay! I have started giving lessons to some clients, and I am working on looking ahead and preparing for what the client needs. I do different variations, modifications, self-practice, and et cetera, but sometimes after I finish the lesson, I feel like I don't know what I'm doing at all. It makes me want to read more, watch your videos more, and learn more. I'm working on it, but I still keep feeling this way. Is this normal? What do you suggest to do to get over this? And she also wrote, also, from your point of view, when we hear people talking about passion to teach, what do they mean? Will you please describe it to me from your perspective? What is this quality, and how does it show up in the day-to-day? I have a map, and I need a compass. Thank you so much, Katrina. All right. Well, let's see. I'm going to tackle the first question first. Okay, I know where this particular instructor is at, and she has just started teaching, as she kind of alluded to, and so she has not done a whole lot of regular client teaching. And so I just want to say, first off, you'll hear me say this over and over again because it's such a common thing that is completely normal, and if you didn't feel that way, I would be scared. And if you didn't feel that way, you should be scared, because at the point you're at, what happens is you know enough to know what a good teacher looks like, and you have not had enough time yet with the amount of teaching hours that you've done to be good at it, to be doing that. And so it's kind of painful to know how bad you suck and to know how far you have to go. And that's a good thing, because if you thought you were good, then probably you didn't know what a good instructor really looked like, and you didn't have a good vision of what that should be, and therefore you probably wouldn't grow very much. And I have to say, a lot of people, when they go through training, think they're really good and never really grow. And they just kind of don't get that, you know, they're a beginner and they should be a beginner. And, I mean, that's okay. Everyone starts out there. And that's, you know, not the place to stay. And they lack the vision of where they're going to be going as a teacher. So it's a good thing. Embrace it. It's painful. It's awkward. It's awful. And I totally relate to you and remember that. And any good teacher will remember that awkward place where you're teaching. You're like, oh, this is coming out terrible, and I know it's not good, but it's all I got, and I feel like I know nothing, and it's fine. It's okay. That is why we charge a lot less for apprentice lessons. Now, with the PMA, they have set a bar for how many hours that you must teach a minimum to qualify to take the test. Okay. Now, I just want to emphasize, this is a minimum. This is a bare minimum that they feel like you have any sort of possibility of being competent at that point. Okay, so a lot of people look at this as like, oh, I'm a good teacher once I get to this point. No, this is the beginning. Okay, very, very beginning. If you add up how many hours you're teaching a week and then multiply it out by how many weeks you're teaching a year, meaning most people go on a vacation here or there and such, that'll give you how many hours you've taught that year. And I would just encourage everyone to do this because there's a lot of books and stuff written on becoming an expert takes 10,000 hours. 10,000 hours. And a lot of people in our industry teach very part-time, so maybe they teach 15, 20 hours a week, and maybe even less than that, a lot of them. And I think that's fine. I don't see anything wrong with that. But at that rate, it's going to take, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, or something. I'm not doing the math offhand, but it's a long, long time in order to get to that 10,000 hours. Okay, so what we're doing with P3 is we're trying to give you the information that you would glean along that way to try to speed the process up, but with all the information you're getting in the P3 program on what a good instructor is, how to evaluate yourself, protocols, and ways to improve your teaching, it's going to also make it a little more in your face of, oh, wow, I have a long way to go. Okay, so don't get discouraged. You're on the right track, and you'll get there, okay? Just keep plugging along. Do a little more dated every day, and it'll get there a lot quicker. And I can't tell you how many times our instructors that have graduated the P3 program, we've had quite a few that have gone to maybe a conference or somewhere where they've met other instructors that have, you know, maybe been fresh out of training, and they'll talk to them about what they know and all this kind of stuff. And we've had so many people come back and like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize how much more I knew than everybody else when they come out of training. They didn't even know this and this and this. How could they not know that? You know, and it's just funny because we are really giving you so much more information and so many more tools to help you grow. So again, with that comes a little extra frustration. You're in a good place, okay? You're at the beginning of the learning curve, and you should feel like you know nothing because you have a long way to go, and you see that, okay? So you're in the right spot. Embrace the uncomfortable and keep plugging along because it sounds like you're doing a fabulous job. Okay, the second part of your question about passion to teach. What do people mean by that? Well, I think it can mean a lot of different things, but I think basically it means that you get excited about the idea of helping people. And the role that you play as a Pilates instructor in helping people achieve their fitness goals, achieve their life goals, achieve, you know, personal dreams, and being able to assist them in finding the joy in movement again, and being able to be a part of that, if it gets you excited, that's passion to teach. Okay. Now, there can be passion about Pilates, which is different because you can get excited about what the possibility Pilates has and how it does it. But if you actually get excited more, or additionally, I should say, about the process of helping the person do it and being a part of that journey with them and helping them on that, that's more the passion to teach. Being excited to explain what you've learned and help them and assist them in any way you can, that's the passion to teach. Now, how does that show up in the day-to-day? In the day-to-day, you'll see it because the person is excited to be there. This is not the teacher that comes in with grumpy pants and is kind of whining about this or that or always asking for time off or something. If somebody is passionate about teaching, they come in with a smile on their face. They are glad to be there. They are excited to work with their clients. They don't complain about their clients because they're so happy to get to help them, and they're so grateful for it. So even the difficult clients that they embrace and they're like, wow, this is a challenge. Awesome. I'm excited about the challenge. This type of instructor tends to want to do more. They will take that extra step, meaning they'll ask questions for the P3 show. Okay, they'll want to pursue understanding. They'll be looking stuff up and asking other instructors, "What did you do when this happened?" And again, that's why, because so many of you are that type that we have created this question and answer show, because we know that we want to give you resources. If you are passionate to teach, we want you to have that and make it as easy for you as possible. Also, this type of person tends to, you know, maybe, oh, well, she can't come at this time. Well, you know, I can stay later to help her. Now, I want to say it with a big grain of salt, because I don't want you to think that you should just let your clients run all over you and you have no personal boundaries, okay? So hear that well. But this type of person tends to want to go above and beyond for their client because they're so excited about wanting to help people. They just exude this. I mean, this type of person tends to meet someone, you know, out to dinner or, you know, at a party or something, and it just, you know, naturally, oh, well, let me see. And, you know, all of a sudden they're in the back bedroom, you know, checking for a diastasis and stuff, you know, at the party. That's the person that is passionate to teach. The person that is not passionate to teach rarely tells anyone what they do. They rarely are there early. They rarely, you know, do anything above and beyond. A lot of times, you know, they'll have a typical, everyone has a typical bad day, but, you know, they get and the drudge of things. And, you know, if they get a client that isn't just happy-go-lucky and wonderful and loving them, they complain about the client and they try to switch their schedule a lot. They're always taking vacations to get away from it. And these kinds of things is how it shows up. Now, again, I'm just making stereotypes and generalizations. Just because you take a vacation does not mean you're not passionate to teach by any means. I'm just saying, trying to give you a clear picture of what that means. I think one of the biggest things that shows up when they're passionate to teach is how much they want to learn, because they realize, like you said in the first question, that you don't know it all. I mean, even myself, I've taken immense amounts of training. I've taken, you know, four different basic certification courses and advanced certification courses, as well as probably 3 to 4 conference workshops per year for the last, 16 years I've been teaching. So that's a lot of money, time, interest. Plus, I'm always reading new books on anatomy and different things. You can't stop someone. If they're passionate to teach, they want to spend every extra dollar on continuing education and books and workshops and things just because they're so hungry to learn more and the body just fascinates them. So that's you also see it there. If you meet an instructor that's never been to a continuing education event and they've taught for 5 years, yeah, they're not passionate to teach. It's not a money thing. This is not a money thing because there are tons of opportunities if you look for them and ask about them to be able to, like, be a volunteer for some of these conferences and stuff and get to go for free. It's a lot of times it's just a lack of motivation. Their personal life is more important than, you know, learning about this stuff. And so, again, you don't have to be over the top. I'm just saying these are some of the factors, the markers. And that's why I encourage you guys, and I want to help you guys get on fire for teaching because it is so awesome and it's so empowering to be able to help someone. And hopefully you see that coming through in my teaching you. But anyways, okay. So I have another question that just popped in. All right. She wrote, I know it's kind of late, last minute notice for me to attend a POT in Phoenix because, let's see, it's the beginning of April. It's in a couple of weeks. Yeah, but I happen to look at plane tickets, and they're cheaper at the moment. I have my family there, so I won't have to pay for accommodation. It happens to be during the kids' April school holidays, so the timing is right. Ooh, sounds like fun. Anyway, if I went for the 3 days, how many continuing ed credits would I get? I seem to think it would be 1.8 for the 3 days. Does that sound right to you? Yes, it does. How many do I need to get again every 2 years? I think you get 1.6 or 16 or however they do it. Does the 725 cover all the registration for the classes for the 3 days? Please let me know what you think. I've left this until the last moment, which I usually don't do. I'm a planner. Thanks for your thoughts. Okay, so POT Phoenix is coming up, if I haven't announced that. We are so blessed in Phoenix to get it every year, which most cities do not, and it's the Rehab Summit. So there's a lot of PTs there, a lot of people from other places, and there's a lot of special sessions that are more in-depth than usual. So you will get all the CECs you need if you do all 3 days for PMA. I've never had a problem with that, as long as you attend your stuff and get your certificates and everything. You also don't forget that when you are looking for PMA CECs, and that's the Applied Methods Alliance, that's the only third-party accredited certification for Pilates, if you're new to this and don't know what I'm talking about. CECs are continuing education credits. Every 2 years you need to renew, and I believe it's 16 or 1.6. I have to double-check. But either way, you're getting it all at the POTs. And you can also get, I think it's 3 credits for taking CPR training, which is always a great thing to have. I like going over and over again just because I have so many little kids at home. I think it's a good thing. But, you know, for your clients too, hopefully I'll never need to use it and neither will you, but it's always a good refresher. The cost of the POT, again, usually it's not $725, it's much cheaper, but this is kind of the late bird rate. It does cover all the registration for the classes. It also covers some really good food and a lot of extra bonuses. Helen's Body, they just like to love on people. They have, I'm just going off the cuff, so I haven't looked at this, but they always have breakfast, which is like a full breakfast buffet. I'm not talking like continental, like here's some boxes of cereal. I'm talking scrambled eggs, bacon, sausage, you know, smoothies, you know, bagels, all the whole thing. Really, really nice spreads and oatmeal and berries and, you know, the whole thing. It also covers lunch, and they usually, again, have a very big buffet that's got many different vegetables and at least 2 meats and different things, and they usually are very sensitive to things like gluten-free and vegetarian and that kind of thing. And then desserts, they always have nice desserts for lunch. On the Friday, they usually have a cocktail hour, which you can go and they have like free appetizers And quite frankly, you could almost make a dinner out of that. It's very nice, and it's a great time. Don't make plans to go out with friends. Go to that because you can meet all sorts of people. Even though you're tired, go. And then on Saturday and Sunday, everything's over. But Saturday, they usually have some things, too. They usually, I don't know if it's Friday or Saturday, Ken usually does a presentation on the history of Pilates. Highly recommend it because he is so interesting, and he's got so many cool stories about the patents of the equipment and different things, and he's got some of Joe's original equipment and all sorts of different things about the history. Very, very interesting. And sometimes, I haven't seen it recently, but sometimes they'll have Elizabeth Larkham do a Pilates performance, which is like a dance on the equipment set to music, and it's really cool. So cool. I can't even explain it well. Sometimes Valentine and Elizabeth will do it, or just Valentine or just Elizabeth or whatever, but if you ever get a chance to see that, so, so cool. I love it. I've seen it a million times, and I love seeing it. Elizabeth is just so amazing, and she's Elizabeth Larkham. She's great. So they've got a lot of extra bonuses, and it includes everything. So you just, you know, go. I believe you also get a mat, so you don't have to, like, bring your own for all the mat classes. Every morning, there's classes, workouts, and there's mat workouts. Sometimes they have some small apparatus like rollers or rings or something that they use with it, but you bring your own mat. And then they have, you know, the reformer or tower or chair workouts and stuff as well. It's first come, first serve. So if you want to get on the reformers, get your butt there early, okay? I have taught there quite a few times, and people get really pissy because they walk in, like, right at time, and they're like, oh, there's no reformers? I'm like, yeah, people were here an hour ago, you know? It's kind of funny. So there's room for everybody in at least one of the workouts. It's just the reformers, the equipment goes quick. So get up early, get there and stuff. So you'll always get a workout, and you get two long workshops each day. There's 3 hours before lunch, 3 hours after lunch, and then usually extra fun stuff. And they do things, cool things at lunch hour, too. They have, drawings and raffles and stuff to give away prizes and stuff. So lots of fun things. All of it's all included, and you will have a blast. So I highly recommend it. If you can get your butt there, you'll have a blast, and it'll be fun. You get to see some friends. So, anyways, okay, you put some things on here also of what you were thinking of looking at, of taking, and I think what you have down there looks great. I love Brent Anderson. He's so funny. Karen Clippinger is my favorite. I have to say, I'd take anything from her. So she's awesome. You'll love it. She's she wrote the... the Pilates anatomy and kinesiology. I forget the name of it offhand. Sorry, it's like my favorite anatomy book. It's awesome. By the way, she told me that the I guess it's the second edition is coming out of that book. And if you can get the first edition, get your hands on it because the editors have cut out a lot of the technical information in the second edition. So get the first edition while it's out. I highly recommend it. Probably Balanced Body has it. I don't know if it's already out or not. That was I think this fall that she told me that when I saw her at the POT in Chicago. Anyways, little side note. Hopefully that helps you. And I think you'll have a great time. So if you have questions for me, email them to me, katrina@personalizedpilates.com, and I will get to them next week. I hope you have a wonderful week. Remember to pass on your passion for Pilates to your clients and help them to know that everybody deserves to enjoy movement. Thanks.